From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It has been only about a decade that same-sex marriage in the U.S. has been something we've been able to take for granted, even though LGBTQ Americans are legally and openly able to, say, serve in the U.S. military. There are constant attacks from the right against the modest measures of equality that the community has achieved. Worldwide, the situation is similar, where swift progress on equal rights has gone hand in hand with a harsh backlash. My next guest describes this divide as a pink line, which he says is, quote, a human rights frontier that divided and described the world in an entirely new way in the first two decades of the 21st century. Mark Gewisser is author of A Legacy of Liberation, Thabo Mbeki and the Future of the South African Dream, Lost and Found in Johannesburg, a memoir and portraits of power profiles interchanging South Africa. He's also the co-editor of the path-breaking anthology Defiant Desire, Gay and Lesbian Lives in South Africa. His journalism and commentary have appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Granta, The Wall Street Journal, and other publications. He now joins me from Cape Town to discuss his new book called The Pink Line, Journeys Across the World's Queer Frontiers. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So first, how much progress have we seen in equal rights for LGBTQ people around the world in a way that you can compare to struggles of other communities for rights? Has it been sort of faster than other movements?
Sonali, Barack Obama said when he came out as a supporter of marriage equality in the United States that no social movement has moved at such a level that for, he was speaking about gay rights. And I think he's right. I think that something quite extraordinary has happened in the last two decades globally, in that something that was previously not spoken about in many, many parts of the world has become a topic for conversation, has become a somewhat explosive topic for conversation. And as a consequence, partly because of the power of the digital revolution, because of mass migration, because of the way people move so quickly, a notion about LGBTQ equality has really caught fire very quickly globally, as people have been able to go online and find community, find ideas, find solidarity online, and have then sort of worked to download these ideas into their local environments with very mixed results. But yes, I mean, if you look at how many countries in such a short space of time have moved to make same-sex marriage legal? Now, already there are about 10 countries in the world who have granted transgender people the right to self-determination, which means the right to choose for themselves what their gender is without having to undergo any kind of external certification. I mean, such things were unimaginable a generation ago when I was coming out in the 1980s or even the early 1990s.
And we, of course, have to remind ourselves that the flip side of it is that lives were at stake. Lives were on the line. Rights were violated. Lives were lost, right? The price that movements have paid for equality, and equality that's not, of course, even fully granted, but that there's been progress on, has been quite high, right?
You use the word backlash, and it's entirely the appropriate word. What's happened is that, as I said, a somewhat explosive global conversation has been ignited. And issues that weren't previously discussed are now in the open. And inevitably, this has caused fear, this has caused panic, and this has caused backlash. So, for example, the first story I write about in my book is the story of a couple who held a public engagement ceremony in the Central African country of Malawi. And this became sort of front page news, gays engaged. And the next thing, the police swooped in and arrested these two and sentenced them. And they were sentenced in a Malawian high court to 14 years hard labor for carnal knowledge against the order of nature. Now, what's very significant about this case is that until they came out and declared their love publicly for each other, this law was never used against two consenting adults. So suddenly there's a sort of foment in society as a new group of people claim rights. A new group of people take to the streets, often it's cool to take to the streets where there's a clampdown on any sort of civic action. So in countries like Russia or Uganda, LGBTQ communities and movement at the forefront of claiming rights among minorities. And what would happen in these countries, particularly in Russia, in China to a lesser extent, the authorities clamped down on these LGBT communities claiming their rights as a way of showing the broader population that such claim for rights was really not tolerable in their authoritarian societies.
Because we're here in the United States, for my audience, it's a very important issue about how Christian conservative fundamentalists from the United States in particular have played an outsized role in the backlash against LGBTQ rights, particularly on the African continent. Can you expand on that? And I know you write about that in your book.
This is a very important issue, and I write about it at length in my book. So it is absolutely true. Script for a kind of right-wing political homophobia was by the moral majority, by people in the United States, back to Anita Bryant, specifically to kind of wage a culture wars against a sort of secular, quote-unquote, permissive society. Now, what happened in the United States? You look at the opinion polls at the time, at around the time that Barack Obama decided to support same-sex marriage, and there's just an extraordinary shift in American society where this suddenly became a non-issue. The battle was lost. The cult's battle around gay people was lost in the United States. This had two consequences. In the United States, and we can talk about this a little bit later, culture wars began to be waged over transgender rights. But meanwhile, right-wing evangelists needed new fields to till. And it so happened that this was happening at the same time as a generation of African leaders, political and clerical, were looking for ways of gaining power, not only in their own countries, but in the global church community. So this began in the Episcopalian Anglican Church, where Africans were able to use the issue of ordination of gay priests and their opposition to it as a way of becoming a serious global force within the Anglican movement. Now, why is it important to tell the story that way? This is why I think it's important, is because I think while it is correct that right-wing Americans have exported homophobia to Africa, or have exported a certain kind of political homophobia to Africa, that doesn't mean that Africans aren't homophobic themselves and that they don't have their own ideas. And one of the things I write in my book is that to say that homophobia is an American export, it sort of denies African agency in the same way as to say homosexuality is an African export. We Africans, no matter what the color of our skin, I happen to be a white African, but white or black, we Africans, like all global citizens in this digital age, you know, take the ideas that work for us, download them, and indigenize them. But yes, you're absolutely right. Particularly in Uganda, a certain script for how to gain, to grow power politically by using homophobia, played off an American evangelical right-wing playbook.
Tell me about the frontiers that you explore in your book, because they're quite geographically diverse. Of course, South Africa, because that's where you are, and then other nations in Africa. And then you even go to Russia, Mexico, Israel.
I do.
And
India.
And India, yes, your final chapter. So what were some of the similarities that you found in the struggles, in the progress and the backlash? I mean, maybe that's too wide a question. So let me first start with asking you, where were the places you explored and why did you choose those places to go to?
You know, I'll go everywhere, but I absolutely wanted to understand the way it was a global LGBT rights or LGBTQ rights and what effect this movement was having in different parts of the world. So I chose places where I felt a pink line was being staked very clearly around LGBTQ rights in one way or another, where because of the people were defending these rights or attacking these rights, queer people themselves, few people themselves, were sort of finding themselves on the frontier. And in that way, I write about South Africa, and particularly the story of that Malawian transgender woman, it turns out, who was arrested once she was pardoned. She came to South Africa. I go to East Africa, to Uganda, because there was such a powerful political homophobia in Uganda. I go to Egypt because I was fascinated in the way the Arab Spring created space for queer people, the way queer people came out on Tahrir Square in the Arab Spring, how they claimed public space in Cairo, and then how that space was shut down when General al-Sisi held his coup d'etat and wanted to assert a certain kind of strong man identity, show Egyptians that the chaos of the Arab Spring was over. The way he did it was by clamping down on queer people. So Egypt is really interesting to me for that reason. I sort of crossed the Sinai from Egypt into Israel and Palestine because I'm fascinated then, and I think your Pacifica listeners will be really interested in this, in the way in Egypt, in Israel and Palestine, a pink line is traced over the green line, which separates Palestine and Israel. So on the one side of that line, you have a country, Israel, which supports gay rights as a way of saying, look how different we are from those horrible Arab people who are so repressive. And Israel is in fact accused by its critics, including myself, of pinkwashing its human rights record with regard to Palestinians by promoting gay rights. So that's what happens on one side of the pink line, green line in Israel. On the other side, you have Palestinians who come to see LGBT rights as an Israeli weapon being used against them. So you can imagine how Palestinian politicians and freedom fighters feel about LGBTQ rights, given that. Now, my question in Israel and Palestine, as everywhere, is what does this mean for queer Palestinians? And in Israel and Palestine, I tell the story of two couples, one in Ramallah and one in Tel Aviv, who are mixed. One is Jewish and one is Palestinian. So from there, I go elsewhere. I go to Russia because there the pink line is traced so firmly over the old lines of the Iron Curtain, if you want. And on the one side, you've got Europe saying we are promoting equality for all people, and in a way, this is what makes us civilized. And on the other side, you've got Vladimir Putin, or you've got Viktor Orban now, or Andrzej Duda in Poland, who are saying what makes us different from Europe is that we don't tolerate this kind of perversion. And we need to put up a barrier against these decadent, secular, neocolonial ideas coming from the West. And they use queer people to do that. So the way a pink line is drawn in Russia is really interesting to me. And I tell a very tragic story there of a transgender woman who lost custody of her son because a court found that just by being a parent, she was promoting gay propaganda to the son. And promoting gay propaganda to minors in Russia is illegal. So I could go on, but those are some of the places.
Wow. So it seems as though one of the common themes that you see is that some of these right-wing authoritarian leaders whom you mentioned, and I would of course put our own President Donald Trump here in the US in that category, have used gay rights, LGBTQ rights, and demands for human rights as a wedge issue, as an effective wedge issue to say that this is what characterizes the radical liberal left, etc. And, you know, here on the right of the right side of the spectrum, we have the traditional conservative nuclear family, etc. And then you have LGBTQ communities becoming a very serious target. In particular, within that, you have transgender people being singled out with some of the harshest targeting, right? We've seen that here in the US with the fight over, who can use public restrooms, but even more. And do you see transgender people being on the front lines in other countries as well?
Yes, in different ways. I've given the example of how in Russia, a transgender woman was found to be against the anti-gay propaganda law. Now what's happening in Eastern Europe is mapping a little bit what's already happened in the United States, is the way that once gay people have become somewhat more normativized, once people come to know that they have gay or lesbian neighbors, friends, colleagues, there needs to be a new demon. And the new demon is increasingly becoming transgender people. You're seeing that in Eastern Europe, and something called gender ideology. And this is a notion that was really developed in the Catholic Church, in fact, by the previous Pope, Benedict, when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger. This idea that the greatest threat to traditional values is an ideology called gender, an ideology that says that we are not destined to be that we're not destined to have the genders or the sexes that we're born with, but that that gender is a construct. And this is even Pope Francis, the supposedly liberal Pope Francis, has railed against this. Brussels philanthropic organizations are teaching children that boys can become girls and girls can become boys. And gender ideology has become a very powerful tool in the hands of the right-wing populists you mentioned, because it affects children. And the populists are realizing that this is the way to go. It used to be gay for children because gay people are pedophiles. You don't want them teaching you. That was the Anita Bryant thing. That was Proposition 28, Maggie Thatcher's law in the UK. Now that can't be mobilized in the same way, because everybody knows somebody who's gay, there's a new mobilization of ideology, which is, I think, something to be begun. It's all over Latin America. It's a big movement in Latin America, deployed a lot by Jair Bolsonaro, let's say that you cannot teach about gender in primary schools. And people's government, appointed to the government from the Catholic right wing, who are really pushing the battle against gender ideology very hard, and who are at the forefront of the rollback against transgender rights that you're seeing in the US, even as the Supreme Court, of course, rules in that amazing Amy says that transgender people are protected from discrimination in the workplace. Trump's government believes that transgender people are not protected from discrimination when it comes to healthcare.
What about the places where transgender people have made great achievements for equality, for recognition? Let's focus on that, because your book, of course, is not just about the backlash, but the incredible progress and the fast pace of it.
No, sure. Sure. And here's where we come to India.
Right.
And one of the things that just absolutely fascinates me is one, this notion of transgender rights, which is a notion about political rights from Western society. It's because when that notion comes into contact with societies, with places in the world where there are age-old third gender categories, such as South Asia, where you have Hijras, where you have Methis, such as Southeast Asia, where you have people called Babaylan or Bakla. And what's been really interesting to me about India, and this is my final chapter, is I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people called Hijra in India, as you know.
Sonali. And let me spell that out, Hijra, which for our non-Indian audience, H-I-J-R-A would be the spelling of it, right? Absolutely. It's very much a part of Indian culture.
And Hijras are third gender people who have always been part of Indian society and have always had a place in it. But it's a somewhat abject place, let's be frank about it.
Right.
Hijras are sort of cast out. Effeminate boys are cast out of their home communities, or they flee their home communities, often because they're fleeing arranged marriage, and they join this alternate cult of Hijras, which is where they find protection and safety, and where they can work as beggars or as sex workers, but which are also very feudal places and where there's a lot of violence and brutality. And what's been really interesting in India is the way the Hijra community has embraced a transgender rights notion, has taken on the notion of transgender rights. And in fact, there's a really important Supreme Court judgment giving Indian transgender people the right to self-determination and giving them the rights to benefits, to social benefits, to housing, to job benefits, to the kind of benefits that other backward castes such as Dalits get. It's a moot point as to whether this progress is actually being translated into policy. But there it is. So in Pakistan, you know, really a place not renowned for democratic values, transgender people have full rights to self-determination. It's fascinating. In other parts of the world where there aren't necessarily issues of third gender, such as Argentina. Argentina was the very country in the world to give transgender people full rights to self-determination and an absolute torchbearer of transgender rights in the world. What's been absolutely fascinating for me, Sonali, as I've tracked the sort of passage of the pink line globally, is how the way the world is divided is not necessarily the way you would think it is when it comes to human rights of the West versus the rest. That at the same time as in a place like the United States, the rights of transgender people are being rolled back. The rights of data in places like India or Argentina.
So finally, where do you think the future lies? I mean, and also, do you feel that the attacks on the LGBTQ community are even raised in a strong enough manner when movements fight back against these conservative authoritarian leaders? I mean, it's one thing for the community to fight for its rights. It's another thing for, you know, all people who believe in progress, who believe in equality, who believe in human rights, to include the attacks on LGBTQ folks in their struggle against authoritarianism.
You know, there's a terrible vicious cycle that unfortunately has been activated in pink line politics over the last two decades. And this cycle is, whenever people like us in the so-called West support LGBTQ rights in a place like Russia or in a place like Egypt, then it's just so easy for the other side to say, you see, this is a Western thing. These are Western values, and the West is trying to invade our society and contend with its decadent ideas. And the only way of kind of stopping that vicious cycle, I think, is for indigenous movement in favor of the rights of all people to grow within these societies. And in a way, I think India is a very interesting object lesson in this, because what happened in India was that the movement to decriminalize homosexuality in India, which was a very powerful movement in the early years of the century and was ultimately successful after a long battle, worked in two ways. On the one hand, it's sort of part of the global village. This is an India rising moment. We are modern. We are part of the world. We are part of the global village. This is why we embrace this. But they also said, we have certain values and traditions and histories as Indian people. We can go back and look at our Vedic texts, which are all about tolerance. We can go back and look at the iconography on our temple walls, which have amazing examples of gender fluidity. We can look at the writings of our Ambedkar and our Nehru and how they spoke about the importance of people, everybody having rights. And the other thing the Indian movement did is using these strategies, the Indian movement developed really powerful allies, parents, religious leaders, people in business, Bollywood, and all of these movements sort of supported the rights of LGBTQ people in India, and it made a huge difference. And if that kind of movement could happen in other parts of the world, it would make a difference as well. It's way harder in places where there's this really, really viciously homophobic Christianity or Islam. It's way harder in places like Russia, where there's such a powerful politics around defining yourself against the West. But the solution is for these movements not to pretend that they have nothing to do with the rest of the world, because we're all global citizens, but to find local roots. and local traditions, local histories, and to build themselves out of those. And those local traditions and local histories are in every society. I can talk about how in South Africa, there's long been a tradition of traditional healers being transgender or gender non-conforming, because somebody in a male body who behaves in a female way might be perceived to be inhabited by a female ancestor. In the Yoruba tradition of Nigeria, there are amazing gender fluid deities. These are very powerful places to start.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mark, for joining us today and giving us such a wonderful analysis of what's happening globally around this issue. Best of luck to you with your book.
So much, Sonali.
My guest has been Mark Gavisser, author of numerous books, including his latest that we've just been discussing, called The Pink Line, Journeys Across the World's Queer Frontiers. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.